Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Christina Namath, Travel Director at the Commonwealth Club. We are here this evening with two incredibly talented individuals, Ava Roy, the Artistic Director of We Players and Director of Hamlet on Alcatraz, and our moderator, Stuart Bousell. Stuart is an associate artist of Atmos Theater, having previously directed their productions of A Midsummer Night's Dream and The Frogs. He is the founding director of the San Francisco Theater Pub and the artistic director of No Nude Men Productions, for whom he most recently wrote and directed the highly acclaimed Giant Bones. He has numerous writing, acting, and directing credits. His directing credits include productions of Hamlet, The Monk, Edward II, and Love's Labor Lost. His acting credits include the title role of Macbeth with Horror Unspeakable Productions, and his plays have been performed all over the world, San Francisco, New York, Melbourne, Tucson, Portland, and Dublin, and he has been a finalist of the Heidemann Award and the Sky Cooper Award. Please welcome Stuart Bousell.
So it's probably worth saying that I was almost not going to be here tonight because I, like most people in the theater world, had rehearsal scheduled. And when I was sort of tapped to come in and do this, I initially said no because I had rehearsal. And then I realized it's within my power as the director to reschedule rehearsal. So 20 minutes, yes, but you have to be reminded sometimes. 20 minutes later, I called back up my contact here and said, you know, I'd love to do this. And partly that's because of the honor of, you know, being a moderator for the Commonwealth Club, but also because as a theater person, I am endlessly fascinated and always want to talk to anybody who attempts to direct Hamlet. And I say attempts as someone who also directed Hamlet. I've actually also been in Hamlet. I played Horatio when I was 21, my last role in college. It's a play I've spent a lot of time with. And in preparation for this, I went back and I looked at my production journal from directing Hamlet in 2006. And at one point I wrote, directing Hamlet is like singing the Star Spangled Banner at a pro football game. Everyone wants to do it. No one can do it perfectly. And one out of three people are waiting to tell you everything you did wrong and everything they would do better. Anyone who tries to do this is either got to be incredibly vain or incredibly brave. I think that's largely still true. Luckily, theater people are largely pretty vain and pretty brave. But every now and then you also meet someone who's also very innovative, and I think that's a lot more rare. And I do think that for someone to take this play, which is a real monstrosity of a play, it's a bit of a cliche, but Hamlet is one of the most famous plays, if not arguably the most famous play in Western literature, because it is a phenomenal, mighty, incredible play that really you have to tap into a lot as a director to bring out the nuances of this show, and it can very easily overwhelm you. I think then to take that and to put that on a place like Alcatraz Island is really ratcheting up the stakes enormously. And so I thought, wow, I've really got to meet this woman. So hence I am here to introduce you to Ava Roy. Ava Roy is the founding artistic director of We Players. She has served the company both as director and as performer, as an actor. Ava has trained primarily with Shakespeare and Company of Massachusetts, has taught in their youth education programs, and performed with the company. She is an alumna of Stanford University, where she earned her BA in a self-designed major, Ritual and Performance in Aesthetic Education. Ava is proud to serve as the first theater artist on Alcatraz Island by invitation of the National Park Service. In addition to her performance work, Ava is a yoga teacher, world traveler, and a sailor. As preparation for the three-year voyage on Alcatraz, she sailed the Pacific in a 3,400 nautical mile passage from southern Mexico to Hawaii as the first mate of a two-person crew. This is Ava Roy.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
So I think a good place to start is something that's probably a little bit self-evident, but you never know. What are the basics of site-specific theater, and how is it different, both obviously and otherwise, from traditional theater in a theater?
Well, so for me, site-specific theater, every show is built into the unique contours of the environment at hand. So the space itself will describe how we work in it. So it's kind of a different response based on what space we're working in. On some level, all theater is site-specific theater. And theater began as site-specific work. So since we've had fires and have been gathering in circles around fires telling stories, we've been doing theater and we've been doing site-specific theater. When I was at Stanford and how the major came to be, this ritual and performance and aesthetic education, a lot of my studies were in the religious studies department and looking at the ritual traditions and religious drama traditions of ancient cultures and trying to get at what we might learn from ancient traditions to inform our modern theater making. So that I think that theater has the possibility to go way beyond just entertainment and actually help, as Hamlet says, hold us toward the mirror up to nature and give us a greater insight into ourselves. So every space has unique challenges, and those challenges from the space are often the thing that you push against is also the moment of greatest discovery. And every space will have a different way of presenting those challenges. So, for example, when we worked at Fort Point, it's a Civil War fort. It's directly under the Golden Gate Bridge. It's a wind funnel. It's freezing cold. It's wet. And it's really challenging. It's challenging to be heard. It's challenging to do a lot of nuanced work in the studio with the actors and then go into the space and have to tell them, you know what, just be loud. Just try to combat the wind. So there are times when those constraints from the environment end up being difficulties to push against. At the same time, there are tremendous moments of unexpected magic and beauty that are unachievable in an indoor theater. The final moment of Macbeth at Fort Point, on the final weekend, the full moon rose behind Macduff and Macbeth as they battled to the death on the roof under the Golden Gate Bridge, the sound of the cars overhead echoing the crash of the waves against the building. And that's what theater should be, a fleeting moment that's written on the wind that will never happen again exactly like that, and is shared amongst those people, that community, who's there and privy to that particular fleeting event. And even though it exists only in a moment, it will replay in the hearts and minds of the people who were witness to it.
So branching off that, this is sort of a twofold question. What draws you specifically to site-specific theater? And then why specifically Alcatraz this time around?
Well, what draws me to site-specific theater kind of gives me a bit of a segue into how this business all got started for me, which was when I was a freshman at Stanford University. That's where I founded the company. And when I first got to Stanford, I felt an outsider. I grew up in a very small town, and while it's very rich culturally in the summer, and there's all kinds of activities, Shakespeare and Company, and the Boston Symphony Orchestra has their summer home there, and so forth. In the winter, it's a very, very small town. So when I got to Stanford, I felt really out of place. I didn't know how to relate to the environment. I'd never visited the campus. I'd never been to California. So starting to work site-specifically was a way of introducing myself to the space, was a way of developing a relationship with the environment at hand, of developing a sense of place for myself, of feeling at home there. And the big shift is when I realized it was a playground, that I could throw banners off the clock tower and use the sculptures as inspiration for the living sculptures that I would put on the campus via the dancers and the movement troupe that I would work with. So the particular draw for me came from this need to make sense of a place that I was going to live in and that felt foreign, and that eventually grew into a way of relating to space in general. So now everywhere I go, I'm looking with this possibility of how might we use the space,
right.
And you know, what else is here that I'm not noticing at first.
Right.
A big draw for me, I think, is that your stage is multidimensional, and so there can be things that are happening way off in the distance, you know, that our stage is deep and broad and wide and high, and you can look above you and behind you and below you, and that you sort of can step into this sphere of performance. And so we start to dissolve the sharp delineation between stage and seats, like we have right now, and this performer, I'm speaking and you're listening. And when we're working site specifically, we are trying to focus your attention so that we can tell you the narrative and get through Hamlet and you'll get a story. But that while you're going through that journey, you're also having a very individualized experience. And you might notice the flock of birds overhead or the way a child is responding to the work at hand. And so we invite you to choose and change your perspective.
I know that because I've done some site-specific theater both as an actor and as a director, one of the things I really have loved about it as a director is that it can be enormously liberating, too, mm-hmm. To be freed from the constraints of a theater. You can really, as you said, there's multi-dimensions. It's almost more like staging a film sometimes because you don't have to be quite so conscious of certain sight lines, certain things. I mean,
I think there's constraints and affordances to both. So when you're in indoor theater, you have the luxury of really being able to narrow the focus and, you know, get just that moment exactly so and get just that lighting cue exactly so. And there's a real skill and craft in that kind of work, which, you know, when you're working again outdoors, I cannot control the variables, so I have to embrace them because I'm never going to get that moment exactly so because a boat's going to pass by or, you know, there's ambient noise, and so I have to find a way to embrace all of those variables. And at the same time, it is very liberating because the space, sometimes I feel like I'm cheating because the space does so much of the work for us. You know, these spaces, particularly the spaces I've been working in the past few years, totally trump us, and so they demand a humility and a patience when approaching them.
And what are some of the spaces you've worked in prior to Alcatraz?
Right before Alcatraz, we worked at Fort Point, which is that Civil War fort under the Golden Gate Bridge, which can handle anything you throw at it and then some. And then the Albany Bulb, which is on the waterfront just north of Berkeley. It's a former landfill turned community art park, which is a really unique environment because the city came in after dumping was made illegal and covered it in dirt, and it became gradually over time a community park. But it still has these layers of history underneath it, and then a loose collective of artists started going out there, and for the past 2 decades have been going out and building giant sculptures out of driftwood and rebar and repurposing found materials out there. And we did The Tempest there, and you were stranded on this island, Prospero's Island. And then a lot of the work prior to that was on the Stanford campus, varying environs on the Stanford campus.
So when did it hit you to do Alcatraz?
So Alcatraz is the first time that I've been invited to work in a space. Every other show up until now really was choosing a place that I wanted to work in, finding the show that matched with the energy of that space, and then going for it and trying to get permits and trying to talk to the communities involved to get their permission. For example, at the Bulb, before I even went to the city to get permits, I went to talk to the people who live there. There's a community of homeless people who live on the Bulb. And so I went to meet with those people and kind of find out how they would feel about us actors traipsing around their homes before going to the city to get permits. In the case of Alcatraz, Amy Breeze, who's the site supervisor out there, she saw the production of Macbeth at Fort Point, and she was really moved by the production, and she was really excited about the possibilities to actually partner more closely with We Players and the park system. So it came as an invitation. Would you like to work on Alcatraz? You know, I tried to play it cool for half a second. You know, maybe, we'll see. And of course, we began conversations, and it really, what's been unique about this process as well is it really has been a partnership, it really has been a collaboration, and we've been developing our ideas together over the past 2 years to bring Hamlet to the world.
But Hamlet's not your first play at Alcatraz.
No, that's true. The conversation started, and I felt like, I knew ultimately I wanted to use the entire island as the stage, but I felt that before I could use the whole island, I needed to introduce myself to the space. I needed to figure out the logistics of working on the environment on a much smaller scale before doing this kind of total island takeover. And also it was doing an initial piece out there that would be much smaller in scope would be a way to get my head into the themes of the island, which our main kind of central themes of working out there have been issues of justice and freedom. So we did a Greek play, a modern adaptation of a Greek play, last fall, which felt like an appropriate place to enter the conversation of justice. It was a condensed version of the Oresteia. Orestes and the first trial in the Western canon, where Orestes is put on trial for the first matricide. He kills his mother, Clytemnestra, who's married to Agamemnon, right, all that. So it's like and not only was this play the trilogy, but it was also the precursor and the final play, all condensed into an hour and a half piece by Ellen McLaughlin, which we did on the dock landing at of Alcatraz. So when you come to see Hamlet, those of you who are coming to see Hamlet, you'll see this environment that we use. And so this was the first time that I had chairs in 10 years. I almost freaked out the first weekend when we put chairs. I don't work with chairs. I don't know how to deal with chairs. What do you mean they're going to sit down? But we still were able to use the vertical scale. Right. Because as you're sitting in the chairs, you're looking at the amphitheater, but then we used all three stories of the building that's right there, and then up above that you see the burned-out warden's mansion, and even beyond that, the lighthouse in the distance.
So Alcatraz came first. You got to know the space. Mm-hmm. You discovered your themes of justice and freedom. Mm-hmm. Then the next sort of jump is, why Hamlet? Because Hamlet is the cornerstone of Western literature, really.
Yeah.
And for people who don't, I always like to say, for people who don't understand how important Hamlet is, the three most written about figures in Western civilization are Jesus, Napoleon, and Hamlet.
Mm-hmm.
So Hamlet is an iconic figure, right up there with Jesus. And so why Hamlet? Why choose the mother of all plays to do at Alcatraz once you finally had felt out the space?
Why not? No.
Because I don't think
that's
small,
not a very good,
that's why.
That's not a very good answer. It's funny, actually, because before we did the first play out there, I went to the island, I started to learn about the island. I like to go to the place and kind of stand in the middle of it and let its currents move through me and just try to get information about the space before we proceed. And I have to say that first time I went to Alcatraz, I'd never been there before, I was seeing Hamlet all over the place. And it's one of those things I can work on answering your question and kind of talk my way towards why at this point. But sometimes, as an artist, your impulses don't necessarily make sense.
Right.
I'm not necessarily able to articulate the why, but just a felt response to the space. I just, in my mind's eye, I was seeing images of Hamlet all over the place. And in fact, I actually felt like it was too obvious of a choice after that experience, and so I tried to shove it into the closet and not think about it and try to entertain other ideas and not go for my first impulse. And I actually was trying to entertain not doing Shakespeare because that's kind of my go-to, and I wanted to challenge myself. Not that doing Hamlet right. on Alcatraz isn't a challenge.
But I know what you mean. As a theater person, it's sort of, it is our sort of fallback plan.
If
we don't have any ideas, Shakespeare wrote some good plays.
Yeah, Shakespeare wrote some really good plays.
Yeah.
So, I tried to, I actually went sailing to prepare myself for this journey on Alcatraz. And so I went sailing for about 5 months, and I brought a bunch of books with me, and I was entertaining Dostoevsky and other authors who deal with issues of crime and punishment and justice and incarceration and the struggle of the self. And then I kept coming back to Hamlet, and I kept coming back to Hamlet and thinking, but this is what Hamlet's going through. This is the struggle of the self. This is why Hamlet is one of the most written about characters. This is why so many people, even if they don't know the play intimately, know his name. Is on some level, he is the everyman. He is struggling with...
We're all Hamlet, yeah.
These issues of to be or not to be. I mean, he's struggling with making choices in the world.
Sure.
With consciousness and with conscience and how to be and what to do and the pressures of being told what to do, but how that is in conflict with his moral sensibilities or the repercussions. He's actually thinking beyond the moment of action and what the consequences might be.
Right.
And so it ended up feeling like right at the heart of what Alcatraz is about. When people go there, and I overhear tourists and visitors walking through the halls and talking about the space, none of them imagine themselves in the role of the guard. They all imagine themselves as a prisoner. They all wonder what it would be like to live inside one of the cells. They don't wonder what, as much, at least what I overhear, what it would be like to be in the gun gallery looking down, even though that's also a cage that you spend most of your day in. But anyway, most people think about what it would be like to live in one of these cells. And as I kept coming back to Hamlet, I kept thinking about, you know, again, he talks about in the nutshell scene, oh, I could be bounded in a nutshell and count myself a king of infinite space, were it not that I have bad dreams, and goes on to talk about how nothing's either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. And so that seemed to me right at the heart of, do we create our own prisons, or can we be the source of our own liberation? And on what level is that a personal choice? Is freedom a personal choice? And furthermore, is freedom fundamentally something that can be given or taken away? You know, is it something that you can find a relationship to your own truth and freedom, even in an oppressive and impossible situation? So those were some of the reasons that I couldn't get away from it, and it felt like it chose me. And then there's the part where Hamlet is big enough to live in the same sentence as Alcatraz. Those two words can live together. It's like measure for measure and Alcatraz. No. you know, Midsummer Nights, no.
Yeah.
So.
But because they are so big, you know, I mean, because they are such... Okay, so we're taking, you know, Western literature's most famous play. We're taking one of the most famous places in America, you know, and we're going to put them together. How do you, as a director and as an artist, sort of still find your own voice, create your own production without being overwhelmed by those things? You know?
Well, I think it goes back to some of what we were talking about working site specifically. It really is a process of humbling myself to the space and letting it inform the work and letting it influence the work.
So how did it in this case?
Well, you'll see, those of you who are coming to see the show, that as we move from location to location around the island, scenes are specifically chosen for specific environments based on the architecture and based on the energy of the space. So the nunnery scene happens in the hospital, and hopefully if you come see it, that may make a kind of physical sense to you, even if I can't quite get at it in words. And then there's other places that are these sweeping dramatic environments that have the backdrop of the cell house and the lighthouse. So when Hamlet's talking about Denmark's a prison, then is the world one? You know, the actor doesn't need to indicate. He can just hold up his hand and the backdrop is there. And also we go in and out of closed areas and open areas. So I'm trying to work with that in the arc of the play as well, so that there's this flexion between these kind of confined indoor spaces and these confined oppressive scenes, and then these more expansive environments. One particular example is where Claudius's attempt at prayer happens, is in the mouth of the powder keg, which is a Civil War era ammunitions area, and it's a cave that's carved into the hillside. So he's literally in this kind of mouth of this confined environment, and on the hillside above him, Hamlet can climb up on the hillside and be directly above him. So we're actually able to stage what the text calls for, is Hamlet sort of looming over him, about to do it, about to pounce, and the space just kind of supports us in doing that. The other thing about why Hamlet is... at this stage, it's a little bit harder for me to talk about why. It was easier for me to talk about it why in the earlier stages when I was trying to convince people that it was a good idea. Because now it's alive. Now the play exists. Now the experiment is open and it's ready for all of you to come and interact with it. So I feel like in some way I need to step back now from answering that question fully, because it's the time when the people who come to see it interact with it and they tell me why. And some of the blogs that people have been writing and the audience's unsolicited feedback has been amazing, and they're getting layers that aren't intentional or that I could have never gotten. And it just kind of, for me, is a case in point about how site-specific theater works, is that because, as you said, Alcatraz is this tremendous icon and has... and people have a relationship to it or an idea about it, even if they've never visited it, it therefore can provide these kind of layers of significance and meaning that is unique to each viewer as they're seeing the play unfold.
Excellent. So in light of that, kind of thrown off guard for the moment because I'm now thinking about what you said instead of thinking about the next thing I'm supposed to say. Want to show some slides, Ava? Is this a good time for that?
Sure.
All right, go for it.
Absolutely. Well, I'll just scan through a few of these. And I guess this just gives you a bit of a sense of the range of not only work that I do, but that is possible working site specifically. So before I launch in, actually, one thing about starting the company was it did come as a direct response to being a student at Stanford. And the very first play that we did there was Romeo and Juliet, which, if you know the play, it starts with a fight. Samson and Balthazar are biting their thumb at each other, and it turns into an out-and-out brawl between the Montagues and the Capulets, which the prince has to come and interrupt. Well, this scene was staged in the cafeteria at high noon, so where the maximum number of students would be there, Samson and Balthazar jump up on the tables and start fighting in Shakespearean prose. So there's something that's catching your attention about it. And then the brawl kind of spilled out into the courtyard. And it was interesting because people really thought that they were fighting at first. And then, of course, the prince shows up and rebellious subjects, enemies to peace, throw your mistempered weapons to the ground and stops the fight. And what we discovered with that play was that where only 60 people, friends who knew I was up to this crazy business, came to meet and see the show, by the end of that first performance, we had doubled the audience. People were catching on as we were moving through the campus and were dropping what they were doing and were joining the parade and wanted to kind of be part of it. So that's kind of how it got started. These shots are from the last piece I did at Stanford, which we did at the Stanford Mausoleum. The audience was instructed to meet at a street corner at campus and university. And from you can see the kind of by the inquisitive looks on their faces, they can see something down the road. There's a very long road in front of them. And at the very end of that road is the mausoleum where the Stanfords are buried. And we're a bit fuzzy because we're quite far away. So they're looking and they can't quite see, and there's basically the entire cast running full force at them. And we are running and we're running, and finally we get close and we split and we run at the audience and we engulf them and we draw them down the rabbit hole into Wonderland. That's me as the Cheshire Cat. It's a very physical show, and we went back and forth off this main road through the surrounding environs. As you can see, it's a very physical show. We built this 10-foot jungle gym for Humpty Dumpty. So rather than Humpty Dumpty being a precarious egg, his precariousness was his daredevil stunts 10 feet in the air. And the Dormouse. And again, kind of illustrating the kind of... those are the Tweedles. They lived in the same pair of pants. And some of these shots kind of illustrate, again, the depth of the environment and that you can have things way off in the distance. And a character that you might encounter further along, you get a glimpse of early on, which is kind of fun. And also the direct audience engagement. So this little girl got to be right next to Alice and interact directly with her. The most basic level of participation is just physically following the show from place to place. We don't demand a lot out of you as an audience member other than follow the show. However, there are other ways to involve. And as an audience member, you really get to choose and change your perspective from which you view the show. I did go back the following year to do a production at a house that I used to live at Stanford. We did a production in their backyard, and it was a dinner theater production. And we also invited local artists to do an outdoor sculpture garden. These are these 30-foot chairs that an artist brought and installed in the garden. And then you had these costumed fairies and performers handing out edible flowers and scraps of love sonnets and poetry. Our theme was love, and we had the actors. This is a former engineering, a retired engineering professor who joined our motley band of players. And you had these actors proclaiming sonnets and monologues from the windows and balconies of this four-story building. This is Richard and Lady Anne, although, of course, the gender roles are reversed. And again, performing from the windows. And this gives you a bit more sense of the scale, where we're using this three-story building, the roof, the windows, the balconies, people are appearing and disappearing. So in this case, the audience was still, but the action was changing. And then we threw buckets of rose petals on your heads and then came down to have dinner with you after. Most of the shows, we do have a feast after. A big part of doing theater for me is the community engagement. And so we really love to talk to our audience after and to not have all this kind of hidden backstage stuff, but make it much more personal and talk to you. Unfortunately, on Alcatraz, you got to catch that boat. So you can't talk to us after the play. You have a boat to catch.
You don't think it would be highly interactive to make everyone swim back? Just to really experience.
You know, we were trying to wrangle the dolphin club and kind of get them involved.
Or you have to build your own like raft, you know, like
a that's a great idea. Like exactly, like
to really understand freedom and justice.
There we
yes.
go. We yeah. might need to work together on the next project. These are a few shots from The Tempest, which I mentioned at the Albany Bulb. Again, details.
And
this is one of the aerials. In this case, we had about 8 aerials. Again, because our stage is so deep, we have miles of stage to work with, that it seems silly to only have one fairy. We should have many of them, so they can be spread out in the fields, climbing the trees, that everywhere you look, there's some spirit surrounding you. We staged the shipwreck right on the beach there. And so every time we did the show, it was never quite the same configuration of sailboats, but there was always a tremendous backdrop of the Golden Gate Bridge and sailing vessels. We built this kind of sculptural suggestion of a boat, and one of the aerials climbs 15 feet in the air to conduct the storm from the crow's nest. And again, as far as community involvement, that prow of the ship that you can kind of see was so heavy that once we built it, it lived there. And it was really awesome to see kids playing on it and how the regular park visitors would add to our sculptures, and really embracing that things that they would add or change or do was just enhancing it, and not being too precious about the things we brought to the space. That's Prospero conducting some magic and torturing poor Caliban. And again, details in the space, fairies along the way, and the multiple aerials. And here you can see the audience is in the glaring sun. This is not a problem you will have on Alcatraz. Please bring layers. Please bring closed-toed, comfortable shoes. Bring more warmth than you think you need. However, here at the Bulb, you needed sunscreen and hats and sunglasses. I included this shot because when Miranda and Ferdinand were married, people passing by thought it was a real wedding. And were cheering and thought it was a real marriage celebration. This is an example of the sculpture out there. This is about a 25-foot sculpture made out of driftwood that, again, we're, you know, riffing off of, and we're using the imagery to inform us. And there she is leading us up the trail. Musicians usually lead the action from place to place. It helps carry the energy of one scene to the next. And there's this sort of Pied Piper phenomenon where people will follow the people playing music. So music is really crucial in our shows. And again, another example of nature just kind of supporting the work with the sun silhouetting Prospero, conducting his magic. And I'll just show you a few pictures from the most recent shows. The witches dancing on the roof, again, directly under the Golden Gate Bridge, embracing the wind. We had a Scottish bagpipe, and he spent most of his time on the roof. At Fort Point, because you can't see, you're inside of these kind of stone corridors and narrow passageways, and it's very dark, and the actors couldn't necessarily see each other from one place to another. We had a bugler roaming, a bagpipe on the roof, and a kettle drum on the ground, so they could see the action, and they could give verbal cues, so the actors could be, I heard the bagpipe, it's time to switch scenes. You came in through the steel doors. You met the witches immediately. The steel doors close behind you, and you are locked inside of Macbeth's fortress for the next 3 hours. There's a sense of the scale of the space. There's one of our Macbeths. And here, when we came to the banquet scene, it was kind of a built-in intermission where the entire audience was invited to join Macbeth's table. Macbeth hadn't showed up yet, and it was full of food, and you got to eat the real food at the table and hang out, and the next thing you know, Macbeth shows up and starts seeing ghosts right next to you. And then when Birnam Wood comes to Dunsinane, we rush the audience to the roof for safety, and we get them to the roof, and the final battle ensued on the roof. And as I mentioned before, we had the sunset one weekend, the full moon on the next. This is a good example about how the space describes how we use it, because in the case of Fort Point, because some of the areas are so narrow and you can only fit about 40 or 50 people in those locations, we ended up breaking the audience into three different groups. So when you arrived, you were given a number, you were broken into three groups. There were multiple trajectories through the space that overlapped and coincided but were distinct from one another. And then just a few shots from the most recent show we did on Alcatraz. This is the Greek chorus. You will see this building when you arrive on the dock landing. And again, the vertical scale. Electra was chained to the wall and lived in a dirt pile for the whole show. And then we did invert the playing space, so you started seated looking at the amphitheater, and then you got up and you switched so that you could see the city, which had, as the play progressed, night fell, and when you turned around, suddenly the whole city skyline was lit up and you remembered where you were. And I think part of what this work is trying to do on some level is invite you to expand your sense of self in the scheme of things. So that's one of the things I'm hoping that we're giving you a little bit of practice at coming to the show, that within the kind of heightened experience of the performance, that you're honing your sensibilities, you're practicing choosing and changing your perspective, noticing things in the distance, potentially becoming a bit more sensitive to your day-to-day environment. So there are my slides.
Excellent. Sort of in light of that final remark then, we'll do one more question with you and then we'll open it up to the audience.
Sure.
But Commonwealth Club is civic, oriented. Art. Why do we do art? Why is art necessary? Why do we need art in society? Have any thoughts on that?
Let's hang out here for the next 3 hours.
Right.
Well, I think that for me, good art should shift something in me. It should awaken something in me. It shouldn't be easy to shake. It should keep me working on it as it works on me. It should leave some kind of residue that then replays in my memory, that gets me thinking, and that opens up my senses so that I might start thinking about myself, my position in the world, my day-to-day environment in a new way. So that's some of what I think art is supposed to do, is help us become more sensitive, empathetic contributors to society.
How do you think that your art that you're doing here in particular is a good way to reinforce that or to make that happen?
Well, I hope that what we're inviting you to do is, first of all, because you're in this sphere of performance and you're outside, it's a full sensory engagement. You're not just looking and listening. You're feeling the wind on your skin. You're moving through spaces. And not only are you looking, but again, you're looking in the distance and up close and behind you. So you're really, your full sensory apparatus is engaged. That's one of the things. And I'm hoping that as I was starting to say earlier, that it helps you practice paying attention. And that in a world where, and I'm guilty of it as well, where I walk down the street texting and on my phone and getting from point A to point B and I'm multitasking and I'm really busy and I'm thinking about the next thing, that art should help us slow down and pay attention and savor. And I think that those are ways to really learn to enjoy your life, is to savor the simple things and notice the details and appreciate what's happening around you, that there's art happening all around us all the time if we would but notice it. So I think that this work is helpful in encouraging people to expand their senses and expand their sense of the way public space can be used.
To engage more fully.
To engage more fully, absolutely, and to invite people to then imagine. You know, wow, I never imagined Alcatraz being used in this way. And so perhaps the next day you might be walking to work and start wondering and imagining on your own. So those are some of the things I hope this work does.
Are there any questions for Ava? Just shout them out.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, I have wondered, I know you've got some matinees that you're doing, or have done at least, in the middle of the afternoon on maybe a Sunday or a Saturday, and you started the evening performances around 5:30, I think, mostly. The visitors are still there at that time. How do you manage to sort of divide the audience from the visitors, or don't you? How do you handle that sort of logistic kind of
thing? That's one of the things that's really wonderful about working on Alcatraz is that in the daytime shows, the regular park visitors are most welcome and encouraged to join us for the scenes that happen in public spaces. So our audience expands when we're in those public spaces. When we go into the closed areas, the escort-only areas of the environment, only if you are a designated audience member and you have your proudly wearing your Wii Players sash will we let you into those areas. So as a designated audience, you're going in and out of the public and the private areas. As a regular park visitor, you can definitely join us for those scenes in public spaces. And one thing that we're doing to try to help make that more smoother, more integrated, is that the rangers, we've been working with them over the past year to help interpret why we're doing this, why Hamlet, what Hamlet's about, so that then they can talk to the regular visitors and engage them about their experience of seeing just that one scene.
Anyone else?
Is it, I've read a few things. Do you have a woman playing Hamlet?
Do you have a woman playing Hamlet?
Is that part of the philosophy of the company, or anywhere, how did that come about?
I think originally it came about because growing up studying with Shakespeare and Company, I played a lot of male roles. I played Henry V when I was 18, and it was a pivotal experience for me. And so I grew up just treating the text as text that could belong to anybody. And so actually this is the kind of most straight casting I've ever done. When we did other shows, there's been a lot more role reversal and gender switching, which is not necessarily to make some big heavy-handed statement, but rather suiting the actor to the text. That said, I think in the case of having a woman play Hamlet, Hamlet is a very sensitive individual. On some level, he's not his father's son. He's not the warrior that his father was. He was probably brought up by his mother and by women. He's much more connected to his poetic sensibilities and his emotional sensibilities. And I think a woman has a lot of access to that kind of current that's moving through him. That said, I knew that if I did have a woman playing Hamlet, that would be the only cross-gendered casting, because I didn't want that to be so in your face that it would be too difficult for people to engage. So, yeah.
Interestingly enough, when I directed Hamlet in 2006, we did role reversal. We had women playing all the men's roles.
Oh, really?
And men playing Ophelia and Gertrude, and then Rosencrantz and Guildenstern were done as twins, so there was one male and one female. And we didn't do it in drag. They played it very true. There was no attempt to be female or be male, just to play the characters as true. But we had a lot of people tell us that it forced them to reconceive the roles, to really reintroduce themselves to the characters. But my motivation behind it was just that, for me, and this is what I love about Hamlet and all good theater, is that you really can make of it what you will. The play has always been about power and intimacy within families. And in my family, the women are just infinitely more powerful than a lot of the men. So it just made sense to me to sort of recast it along those lines. But that's interesting how you're approaching it. So.
Yeah, I mean, along those lines, the first time I directed Hamlet, we had four Hamlets and four Ophelias, and there was a similar thing that came about. Was it just kind of allowed you to really see these different aspects of Hamlet's personality and Hamlet's consciousness kind of made manifest by these multiple actors?
Yeah. The thing that I remember the most is someone saying to me afterwards that they'd always found Ophelia so whiny as a woman, but as a man, it was much more heartbreaking than they'd ever seen the character before. And I thought, why? Why do you think that? That's an interesting question right there. Why is it more sad when a man commits suicide for love, you know, so to speak, or whatever? Anyone else?
What's the response time from what I guess called the normal theater world?
The traditional theater world. Let's not insult the other thing.
Well, the response that gets back to me has been people get really excited. I can speak more specifically to the actors who are working on this project who otherwise have done more traditional theater, and for many of them, the majority of them actually, this is their first experience working site specifically and working in this way, and it's really exciting. It's really engaging as a performer. It's gone are the days of exit stage right, enter stage left. It's now run a mile across the island and be there on time. So for the actors, it's really exciting. And I think there's been good response from people invested in theater, because it's just another way of experiencing this work. And as we kind of started talking about it very early on, it's innovative, but it's also as old as theater is.
Yeah, once upon a time, all theater was like this.
Right, yeah. Exactly. In whatever grove or coffee shop or, you know, outdoor environment or wherever people were gathering. And also in other countries, there's a lot more tradition than we have in our own of piazzas and public squares and public gathering places where these kinds of happenings occur. And it's a bit more unusual and seems so much more innovative in our culture because we don't have that much of a tradition of these kind of public gathering places.
How has it been for you to balance the logistics of the production and your own artistry of building the scene?
I'm really glad we started early this project. This has been a huge logistical undertaking, huge, partly because the island is tremendously intricate and complex, also because there are many different entities, organizations who work on the island. It's not just the National Park Service, there's also the Golden Gate National Parks Conservancy. Which is a separate entity. They work together, but they're separate entities. There's the Alcatraz Cruises, which is a private ferry company. There's the maintenance, there's the staff. So there's all of these different, there's the volunteers in parks programs. So there's a lot of different personalities on the island and different interests in the island. And also there's not really a precedent for this work, not only on Alcatraz, but in our national parks. So it's been very challenging logistically. That said, working with Amy Breeze, who's a site supervisor, is really inspired and really a visionary. So while it's been challenging, we've been working hand in hand to try to navigate those challenges so that it would work for everybody. But in terms of your question, I've been really trying to. It's an ongoing practice for me. Part of the practice is when I'm in the room with the actors, trying to just be in the room with the actors, and that's something that I get better some days than others. And when I'm in that meeting, trying to be just in that meeting, I think having a longer gestation process with this project than I've had for any other project has been really helpful in actually structuring in the time to just be working on the kind of logistics management prior to launching into rehearsals. But that said, we players is really at a pivotal stage in our artistic life as a company. Up till now and through now, all of my actors, everyone who's working on the project is working as a volunteer. Collectively, we've contributed over 10,000 hours in 10,000 volunteer hours to the creation of this project. So it's really a turning point of figuring out how to make this work sustainable, financially sustainable, so that we can continue to do it. And so we're really at the crux of figuring out, I need more staff. I need more people helping me on the production and logistics aspect so that I can be more freed up to take care of the actors and the creative work.
Sort of branching off that, why, and this is a question that I think all artists should be asked at some point, why do you think people are willing to give up so much of their lives to do something like this. Because we all do. I mean, there's no one more underpaid, I think, than stage actors out there, as far as like amount of time versus what you're likely to get as a stipend, if you get anything as a stipend. You know, stage actors, stage crews, mm-hmm. stage designers. Why do people put so much into
a mystery,
art.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it's a total mystery. So what do you think?
Allie wants to say something.
Because it's so much fun. It's so much fun. You get so much from it. There's so much community that's around it. And it's just, it runs the gamut of being really wonderful and funny and fun, horrible, but you got to stick together because you still got to get through the show.
Yeah, I mean, I think that point about community, for me, I'm really focused on, Lauren and I often talk, Lauren and I work very closely together with We Players, and we often talk about we build a community that builds a show. And there's a lot of emphasis in We Players, that's why it's We Players. There's a lot of emphasis in building a community that supports each other so that we can navigate the tremendous challenges and storms that both the environment and the space will throw at us. But that it's also a way of introducing ourselves to the communities and the individuals who inhabit the spaces we work in. But why do we do it? I mean, it demands so much. It's so taxing. And it gives so much back. You know, in life experience, some of my most profound relationships and friendships have come out of this work. So there's a lot that comes out that doesn't equate on paper at all.
Right.
But again, these kind of memories and the way that spaces are transformed forever having inhabited them in these ways.
Any other questions?
We've had some people ask about taking children to these performances. And do you find that kids and young people react differently to theater in this way? Because they're moving, they're in a space, do they pay attention more?
So I'm part 7-year-old, and I deal better when I can get up and move around. I don't deal very well when I have to sit for too long. So I think that, yeah, for kids, you know, you get to get up, you get to move around. Being distracted is okay because you're distracted by a bird or colors or something else. One of my favorite pieces of feedback is that you make Shakespeare fun and accessible even for kids. It depends on the show, though, because The Tempest at the Albany Bulb was much more accessible for children. They were outside, it was sunny, it was warm, there were fairies running around, there were colors. Alcatraz is a lot harder. You're walking a lot up and down hills, it's cold. So it depends on the age of the kid, of the children and the space. That said, one of my favorite performances so far, how old do you think Sam was, Steve? He was 8 or 10, that little boy? Something around there. He was running from scene to scene. He was like practically beating the actors from scene to scene. He was so excited. And when we found the blog of his parent who brought him to the show, he had a top 10 reasons why this play is so good. And that was fun anyway. But the top 10 reasons, and one of the reasons was, now you can have engaged conversations about Shakespeare with Sam, his 8-year-old son. And that was really, really precious. That said, it's not really appropriate for babies, or, you know, because of the environment itself. So
a closing thought, because we're almost out of time here. Top 10 things about this play. What's top one thing for you? What has been the best thing about this experience for you?
How long can I sit here and think about it?
You got about 60 seconds.
60 seconds. The top experience, the number one thing about this experience. I mean, I guess the two things that are immediately coming to mind are certainly the community that we build, both with the people making this show, and all of the people that I've both been able to meet and develop relationships with throughout the process. And that goes hand in hand with my relationship to the space. I had some pretty intense experiences on Alcatraz early on that were really humbling, and I wasn't sure how we were going to get through it. because I'm very sensitive, and some of the environments out there are very oppressive and very sad, and we are walking on people's graves, and I wondered how I was going to bring the kind of celebratory work that I'm committed to making to an environment that's so fraught, and to feel the way my own relationship to this space has shifted, and finding out that it is possible to remain really sensitive to the suffering of the environment and bring a kind of transformative, celebratory energy has been really personally rewarding, and I'm really grateful for that.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Avra, artistic director of We Players and director of Hamlet on Alcatraz. I'm Stuart Bausell, and now the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Yay! That's my favorite part.